We're in Genesis chapter 28, verses 10 to 15, or 10 to 22. In 10 to 15, we see Jacob went out from Beersheba, went toward Haran. That's typical Jewish history writing. Gives you a big picture. He went from Beersheba to Haran. And then, now let's fill in the details. He came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it in his head and lay down in that place to sleep. Then he dreamed that, behold, a ladder was set upon the earth and its top reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and the south. And you, all the, your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you. I will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you.
So, that's the text we want to start looking at. One of the first questions we ask is, where? Where did it happen? So the first thing let's notice on this map of the, so first of all, getting oriented. There's the Sea of Galilee all the way over to the left or to the west. You see the Sea of Galilee, excuse me. There's the ocean,
or the Mediterranean over here. Sea of Galilee up here, Jordan River, Jericho River. Think about that, and that's kind of the spine of Israel. So it's mostly all over here. And so, now here's Jericho, where they're going to come in after Moses. So Jerusalem's not that far. And when I want to find Jerusalem on the map, I just go to the top of the Dead Sea and go over to about the middle of that mountain range, and there's Jerusalem.
Okay? So, but for our purposes, it says he went from Beersheba. We know that place. Abraham's been there. Isaac has been there. Up to Bethel, north of Jerusalem. And that both those places have continuing influence in biblical history. It's about 85 miles as the crow flies. So that will keep you, give you some perspective. That would be 3 to 4 day journey. Okay. Did you want to see that fly up there again?
Yeah, that was cute.
Okay, let's see if I can do that. There you go. As the crow flies. There you go. All right. Let's think about who's involved in this passage. We haven't done this in a while. Who are some of the characters that we see in the text? Who do you notice?
Jacob.
Angels.
The Lord.
Descendants.
Isaac. Abraham.
The Lord. Did we say that?
We did mention the Lord.
Families.
What families are those?
All the families of the earth.
All the families of the earth. I think you about covered what I got. There's Jacob, angels of God, the Lord. Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, talks about your descendants, all the families of the earth. Okay. So that's kind of a picture of, it's one man alone here, but he's not alone, and this one man really relates to the whole humanity, all the families of the earth. Look at that passage. And one of the things that jumps out to me is the expression of covenant, how it relates to the Abrahamic covenant. Can you see things in there that relate to the Abrahamic covenant or the covenant with Isaac? What are some things that look to the covenant?
The land on which you lie.
Pardon me?
The land on which you lie.
The land on which you lie, yep, okay.
Descendants.
So there's land, there's descendants.
Blessing.
There's blessing in there. So here's some of the things I noticed. Speaking of the God of Abraham, he's saying, I am the God of the covenant. I'm the God of Abraham. I'm the God of Isaac.
mentions the descendants. There's the seed. There's the land in brown. You'll have the land from west to east, north and south. And in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Blessing to the world through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But especially notice when that says your seed, that's a singular noun, but it can have a plural connotation. But notice I put a little crown on it. Why do you think I did that?
Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus is the ultimate seed, and it's through the Messiah that's promised that the blessing of all the nations will come. Now, we could actually point to other blessings. Again, they, for example, gave us the Bible. Our nation is grounded politically. Our legal system, so much of it, comes out of our biblical heritage. I've mentioned before, if you go to the House of Representatives and you look around, there's all these famous legislators from all of history, all around the House chamber. But there's the one face that is not a profile, but that's looking straight on, is directly across from the Speaker of the House, and that's Moses. So the Speaker of the House looks up to the face of Moses all through the process. And so we could look and say, we've been blessed with the heritage of a value system. We've been blessed with an economic system. We could be blessed with a legal system, a judicial process. But most importantly of all, we've been blessed with the Messiah. But through them, blessings come to the whole world. So God chose Israel, but that's not the only people he's blessing. But he chose them to be the channel of blessing. And honestly, that's not always an easy place to be. So yes.
Right.
John.
So all those descendants they're talking about, you have, and all the people that are coming to live on earth, all the families and everything that they're coming in, do you think that is a blessing that they go to, they'll be turned back to dust?
When it says they'll be as the dust of the earth, that's emphasizing they're everywhere. There's a lot of them. How much, just if you want to, for example, how much dust can accumulate, you could ask Jim.
Well, I would say,
But that's what he's saying, is it's everywhere and it's a lot of it. They would know that in the Middle East. And so, again, another one picture that came to my mind is when I thought about the dust, your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. What's this guy's name?
Pigpen,
yeah. He must be Jewish. He's the dust of the earth is tracking with him. Okay, so we talked about we've seen some things, the who's in the passage, who are the people mentioned. We've seen that theme of covenant. That's central to this whole process. And again, I want to mention, the covenant is tied to the land. So it's not to be spiritualized. It's a specific people, a genetic people, tied to an actual place. So the place where you are lying, and to the east and the west and the north and the south of that place, that land is yours. And so that's the covenant. And your descendants will be as the dust of the earth. Okay, as you look at the passage, what else jumps out at you? Any other repetitions or other things that kind of speak to your condition? Yes?
There's an awful lot of references to the place or the land.
A lot of references to the place or the land.
More than normal.
Yeah. Very earthy passage. Good, good.
I will bring you back to the land and will not leave you until what I have.
I will bring you back to this land, he says. Good. And that's kind of, that says something, doesn't it? You know, so you might be getting ready to get on an airplane to wonder, will I be coming back? And you think about the young men who've gone off to war, or missionaries of previous and even current generations, will they be coming back? God here makes a promise. You're coming back. take that to the bank. So yeah, there's a certainty there. There's a promise there.
Is there a reference to the diaspora there before that?
How so?
He's going to spread there. He's going to be going to the northeast, south, and west, and then he's going to bring him back.
That's a good question. Is that referring to the broader spreading throughout the world, or just the land of Israel? Okay, that's worth looking at.
Wherever they go, which he's going to be looking.
Right. But in particular, where he's going, he's coming back. Yes. Yes.
Well, there's one or two I ams or I wills or something in there.
A lot of I wills. God's taking full responsibility for this thing. I'm struck by this word, behold. Three times just in these six verses, 10 to 15. Behold, behold, behold. I don't know, we read our Bible sometimes, we kind of get used to that word, behold. But, I mean, how often do you say behold? Again, maybe if you're getting ready to move and you open a closet that hasn't been opened in a while, or you move a refrigerator, behold! Look what's in here. There's a sense of surprise. There's a sense of wonder. This is an amazing experience. Behold, a ladder to the up, set up on the earth, reaches its top, reaches to heaven. Wow. How often do you see that? It's incredible. Behold, the Lord God stood above it. At the top, there's God himself. Behold, he says, I am with you. Just awe-inspiring in this text. This is an amazing experience in his life. Let's look to this next section. Then Jacob awoke, said, surely the Lord is in this place. There's that land again. The Lord is here. And I didn't know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. I mean, he says, this is incredible. I thought I was leaving the place of promise, and here God is here. And he's the door is open to heaven. Jacob rose early in the morning, took the stone he had put at his head, and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city had been Luz previously. Bethel means house of God. Beth, baked, is the idea of house, ale, God, house of God, like baked lechem, house of bread. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and keep me in this way, I'm going, and give me bread to eat, clothing to put on. So I came back to my father's house in peace. Then the Lord shall be my God. The stone I set as a pillar shall be God's house. And of all you've given me, I shall surely give a tenth to you. That concept of vow that he meant, he makes a vow. What is a vow?
Promise to do.
A promise to do. Who said that?
I did.
Okay, John. Promise to do something. Okay. It seems like it's even stronger than a promise. It's a very solemn thing. It's a very solemn promise. Okay. Let's see where we go from here. And what did Jacob vow?
Submit to God.
He's going to submit to God. It seems conditional. Let's go back a minute and see how he says that. Jacob, if God will be with me and bring me back. Some people might read that and think, is he bargaining with God? Say, I'll make you a deal? I don't think so. And you go through the Bible, the vow really was a statement of faith. And since it was promising and planning the thanksgiving that would follow God keeping his promise. So God, you just made a promise, I'll make you a promise. When I see the fulfillment of the promise, I too will do. I will respond. I will do something in response to your kindness. And so sometimes, like you've heard someone pray maybe, asking for that, and we will give thanks when you bring this healing, when you answer this prayer. So it's not a bargaining, rather it's a statement of faith. you've made a promise, and I'm making you a promise. When you have fulfilled your promise, and I know you will, then I will do this. And so he makes a solemn oath of gratitude. And so you'll see that sometimes in the psalmists, in the Psalms, where they'll say, "I will bring an offering to the Lord," when he answers. It's not purchasing the blessing; it's a statement of commitment to gratitude and trusting the Lord. And so, what in particular did he? So he offered. It's a couple things he said. I'll be obedient, grateful. He mentioned, "I'm going to pour oil on," or he poured oil on the stone. What did he say he's going to do with that stone and that place?
Make a pillar.
Make a pillar. What it seems, what he's describing there looks like he says, "I'm going to come back, and this will be a place of worship." It's kind of like someone saying, "I'm going to come back and build a. If you get me out of this mess, Lord, I'm going to come back here and build a church as an act of gratitude." And so he's saying, I'm going to worship you in response to your grace. What else does he say?
Tithe.
He'll tithe. So two words can describe what his vow includes. Worship and wealth. What is a tithe? It's 10%. And so he's... So one of the things he says is, in response to your grace, I will give you an offering of one-tenth of all that you give me. By the way, it's interesting to notice, you know, sometimes in the New Testament we wrestle with how much should we, you know, give God, what about the tithe? Notice, have we ever seen a tithe before in Genesis?
Melchizedek,
right. Abraham offered to a tithe to Melchizedek, who represented God. And so notice, Abraham and Jacob are both pre-Moses, pre-law. And so you could say, since they are dealing with God on the basis of God's covenantal promises, this is a grace time. And yet the tithe is their way of worshiping. So one way we worship God is with our substance. And I think a 10% is a good place to start thinking about what it means to worship the Lord with our wealth. So there's a biblical foundation for that. Where do we get that idea? It's not just the law of Moses. And you all know, right, in the law of Moses, if you add up the tithes, it works out closer to 25-30%. Because it actually became not just a worship thing, but a kind of a governmental support thing. Steve.
How did he give that tithe? There's no offering place.
No, in the Hebrew, this word pillar suggests a place where an offering plate would be. No, what's that? How did he do that? And what did he do? For one, well, of course, he probably did it with one of those little iPhone-based credit card readers.
Yeah,
like some churches will do that, or. But really, what they would the shepherd would do, and they would count their sheep, and the way they would do it is they'd have them come through a narrow pass underneath their cane. And that'd be one way they could inspect for illness and this kind of stuff. But also, that would be a count. 1 out of 10 would be the Lord's. 1 out of 10 of any harvest he had. 1 out of 10 of any wealth he gained. And you think about it, now he's going away empty-handed. How does he come back? Wealthy. And so what that would mean is we give it to the Lord, and probably that would include mostly sacrifice. You know, what's really remarkable, like you think about the dedication of the temple and other times, there were an amazing number of animals that were sacrificed to the Lord. So, yeah. That's what that would have involved. And so, frankly, it can be a little easy sometimes if the plate passes by to drop something and go through. If you're sacrificing that much of a flock, I mean, that was an endeavor that really said something and really would hammer home, look at all the Lord's given. Because this is just a tenth of what he's given. So, but I'll just say, so what we're noticing is, I will, says the Lord. It's grace. And our response to grace is worship. And that's what Jacob is showing here. He recognized the incredible grace of God, promising him all these promises and assuring him of his protection. And so here I said, is he offering God a deal? Is he buying a blessing? Dr. Ross, one of my professors at seminary, had this comment in his commentary on Genesis. He said, vows were not made to induce God to do something he was not willing to do. They were made to bind the worshiper to the performance of some acknowledged duty. Jacob made his vow on the basis of what God had guaranteed to do. He was thus taking God at his word and binding himself to reciprocate with his own dedication. He is making a solemn vow, I will not ignore your grace. I will worship you in a way that reflects the richness of your mercy to me. And so sometimes, often, I think, we don't thank God for the blessings we've experienced. If we did, you would start with every breath we take, we'd have to have a prayer, a phrase. Every drop of water we drink. Every half a drop of coffee we drink. It calls for worship. No, it's really, he's saying, I'm telling you right up front, I'm committing myself. I will come to this place where you showed me your grace and I will worship you. When you think about this stairway to heaven, what other passages come to mind?
Paul caught up to the third heaven.
Paul was caught up to the third heaven. Good, I hadn't thought about that one.
Jesus' words to Nathaniel.
Is that what the people at the Tower of Babel were
trying to do? Ooh, a Tower of Babel. Mm-hmm. Those are the two that I was thinking of is one, and a lot of I think commentators will say both of them, but in John chapter 1, remember it says Philip met Jesus, believed his Messiah, verse 45, and he found Nathanael and said to him, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Can you imagine the thrill, by the way, of being able to the first time name who the Messiah is? After all that longing. Is he coming? Will he come? I can tell you his name. I can give you his address. Nathanael said to him, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And Philip said to him, come and see. Oh, there's so much good stuff here, but I won't get lost in John chapter 1. But Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him, and he said to him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit. So Nathanael was a man of incredible character. Nathanael said to him, how do you know me? Isn't that interesting? He could actually sense, I've never met this Jesus, never seen him before in my life, and he knows me, and he knows my character. And he said, Jesus answered him and said to him, before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Can you imagine you walk up to someone, I don't know where, at church, and they say, you know, I saw you at the stoplight there in Missouri. What? who are you? How did you see me? You know, and so he said, and Nathanael answered and said, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And when you saw me, I was just no one was around. I was praying to God. The only God, one who saw me was God. You must obviously be the Messiah that they talked about. Jesus answered and said to him, because I said I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these. And he said to him, most assuredly, I say to you, hereafter, you shall see heaven open, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Almost quoting the passage with Jacob. And some have suggested maybe that's what the passage that Nathanael was meditating on. But he said, what is he saying? And What is he saying? How does this fit with, and maybe help us understand the Jacob passage?
Jesus is the point at which you can meet God.
Jesus is that bridge. Jesus is that connection. He's the escalator to the upper floor. He is. He's the. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the door. He says. So he's saying that picture that Jacob saw. I am. That's what I am. I am the connection between man and God. And you will see that over the next couple of years. So the John 1 is one thing that the passage that comes up from Jacob. But the other one is the Tower of Babel before Jacob's experience and the opposite of it. The Tower of Jacob or the Stairway of Jacob is God reaching down to man. What was Jacob doing? He was asleep. That's about as passive as you can get. He's all alone, and God reaches down to him on the basis of grace and promises. Because of Abraham, because of Isaac, I'm blessing you. Tower of Babel is man reaching up to the heavens, trying to basically take for themselves the glory of God. They're trying to storm heaven, if you will. And so, where Jacob's experience is God reaching down, the Babel experience is man with his fists towards heaven. What a contrast. And I think we're supposed to be thinking about that in Genesis. Because Genesis, chapter 11, we already saw the Tower of Babel. Now we're seeing the stairway of grace. And then Jesus comes and says, "You ain't seen nothing yet. I am the stairway. I am God." And he keeps saying, right? God sent me. I came. I am the way. And so Nathaniel, who instantly figured out, wow, you're something special, Jesus said, you know, there's something a lot more special than just knowing you were under a tree and maybe even knowing what you were thinking. I came as the bridge from heaven to earth. And so so that's what Jacob, in a sense, is getting a picture of there at Bethel, the house of God. Any other thoughts or comments on that? Good observation.
Maybe Jesus is also that rock on which you can rest your head.
Huh, yeah. And that's an interesting thing. I've got to do some thinking. People say, did he put his head, was it next to his head or under his head? My most natural reading is under his head. I wouldn't normally think it was a rock. Did he wrap it in that, or, you know, and maybe this is the, maybe he was the first My Pillow, you know, started there. But Jesus is the source of our rest. And that anointing of oil, you know, and that, you know, that he Messiah'd it is the way you can almost translate that. So an incredible, incredible experience. Reminds me of, you know, Jacob later on, before he goes into Egypt, God's going to meet with him and said, "I'll be with you. I'll take care of you."
This was a dream, right? The whole thing was a dream.
Yes.
How was this the main way in which the Lord would speak to back then? Or how to know that it's from the Lord in this case and not, I just had too much caffeine and...
Some good questions. First of all, we see that at different times God did speak in a dream. And not always. You know, or for example, the three men that came, one of them to Abraham, one was the Lord. That wasn't a dream. But Jacob, he'll have a couple of these nighttime experiences with the Lord. Matter of fact, if I count right, Jacob is going to have some 7 encounters with the Lord. Incredible recipient of grace. And it's good for us to have seen, you know, he's not a perfect guy, but God's grace is perfect and about him. I think the key is somehow God, you know, when it's that divine an experience, there's no question. It's just like when Joseph, he had every doubt of Mary. When he had that dream revelation, the doubts were gone. Thoroughly convinced. I'm on track. So the Lord, I guess, can make a very convincing experience of speaking through the night.
Why the image of a ladder with angels up and down? They don't need a ladder to go up and down.
Why is that? Why do the angels going up and down the ladder, stairway, whatever you want to, how we're going to translate that? The word is only used this one time in the Bible. What are the angels about?
God's business.
Yeah, you know, they're messengers of God, and so to me it just makes it very clear. This is a place of divine. You're right, they don't need, that sounds like some of the modern things. This is the portal through which the angels transit. They don't need that, but just to emphasize, that this whole thing is communion with God, the interaction with God in the heavenly places. Steve.
And the Lord said he'd bring them back from Iran to this place.
Yes.
To Israel. He did it twice when he brought them back from Egypt. So the Lord kept his promise three times.
He brought the nation back, yeah, from Egypt, but yes.
And they brought his army back.
Yeah. Right. And so yes, God's faithfulness is merciful. Most of us don't have that kind of a revelation. It says, I'm going to come back to this place. We don't know where we're going to be tomorrow, if we're going to make it to tomorrow. But God basically said, you're indestructible. I will bring you back to this place. I don't know how much he would cling to that. He really grasped the fullness of that. I think there are many a time when he would have gone before the Lord and said, I'm trusting you. But yeah, that was an incredible promise. I will bring you to this place. Well, good. Keep thinking about this text. See what other goodies you can drive out of it.
I think you need to be careful about making a vow to God. You better be sure you can keep it.
Yeah. Our yes be yes and our no be no. But on the other hand, there are places where a vow is appropriate. It's a solemn commitment before the Lord. And that's the whole point. It is a very solemn commitment for which you'll be held accountable. And so he vows a very serious commitment before the Lord. It's a binding commitment.
Okay. That's not what we're supposed to do, though, right? The Bible says we're not to vow.
Well, we're not supposed to take oaths, and there Jesus, when he says that, is talking about the flippant and manipulative oaths of his day. But the Bible specifically would talk about believers taking oaths in the name of the Lord. And in the law, you actually see commanding when you take an oath, you take it in the name of the Lord. So, yeah, I would say it is permissible, but not which shouldn't be common. Primarily, we should just do, and mainly that it's a commitment before the Lord. Absolutely. Where's the passage that says that? Remember? Pardon me?
Yes, be yes.
Yes, be yes, and no, no. That's in the Gospels. Where is it in? In what book we find the comment about keeping your vows? Start with the book. Close. Wisdom literature. How about Ecclesiastes? Oh man, I'm trying to look for it in my Bible, and it's not the book of a Bible. Vow. Search. I want to say it's Ecclesiastes 5, but I'm not convinced of that yet.
Five four.
Okay, Ecclesiastes 5:4. Read it for us, Jim.
When you make a vow to God, Do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Verse 5, better not to vow than to vow and not pay.
Pretty solid. Better not to make a commitment than to make a commitment and not follow through. Okay.